This is Peter Ford, best known perhaps as former British ambassador in the Middle East, in Bahrain and Syria. More recently, political activist helping George Galloway in the Workers' Party of Britain, where I'm now one of the deputy leaders, and putting, I hope, my Middle East experience to good use, because so much of what is happening right now in this country can be traced back to mistakes in British foreign policy. And we're reaping now, in terms of immigration, the effects of our wars of choice in the Middle East, Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Libya. The chickens are almost literally coming home to roost. And of course, that links in with recent sad events on the streets of this country.
So could we start with you giving us a bit of analysis of what you make of this? It was all triggered by some disinformation that three murdered children were killed by a Muslim. But this seems to be, particularly bad that the police did not, make statements at the time denying this, even though it was circulating all over social media, etc. But anyway, what do you make of what's been going on with these far right appearing in the streets and often outside mosques, attacking mosques and outside asylum hostels?
Yes, I thought it was unfortunate that the police did not, as soon as they saw the way things were going on social media, they did not nip the trouble in the bud by clarifying that the accused was not a Muslim. Maybe for legal reasons they couldn't identify the guy as they did shortly afterwards, but they could have put it about, even if not officially, they have channeled, they could have leaked that he was not a Muslim. But let's be honest, a lot of people were just waiting for an excuse. And if it wasn't this incident, they'd have found or fabricated some other, because basically many people want to attack Muslims in this country. And I'm not just talking about the Israeli backers of Tommy Robinson, but politicians have been encouraging anti-Muslim sentiment. It was Suella Braverman, then at the time Home Secretary, who spoke about hate marches when she was talking about marches in which I participated several times myself and know for a fact that they were peaceful, but that because they were Muslim or half Muslim, half of those marching in my experience were Muslim and half were non-Muslim, branded them as hate marches. And the Sunak government, as called out by George Galloway at the time, wanted to make Muslims the subject of the forthcoming general election. They started to whip up latent antagonism, which was already there because of the way the Muslim question had been conflated with the general immigration question. And let's be honest here, when people talk about immigration, mostly they're not talking about white Ukrainians or Hong Kongers. They're talking about Muslims. And also the dog whistle word integration. What do these people want calling for more integration? That Muslims be less Muslim? That they be less brown than they are? Because from what I've seen in places like Rochdale, the locals are extremely integrated. In fact, they're so integrated that half of them didn't vote for George Galloway in the general election when George was the official pro-Muslim candidate. they're so integrated that they forgot about their co-religionary in Gaza, forgot about the massacres Israel is perpetrating, forgot about the support Labour was giving to all that, and they voted Labour. How integrated is that? How much more integrated can they be than voting for a party that has its knife out for them?
Yeah, interesting. What do you make of the failure of the party? I mean, you're actually quite senior in George's Workers' Party now, Peter. Was it just that you spread your butter a bit thin? I mean, you were going for, I think it was 150 constituencies and ended up with losing one.
Possibly we did spread ourselves a bit thin. We did not put quite the same effort into Rochdale that we did in the February by-election, and we ended up, George ended up just missing Rochdale by a couple of thousand votes. But we didn't have much option, because if you want to be a serious political party in this country, you have to get money, government money, the so-called short money, which the state gives to recognized, established political parties. And the definition of established political party is that you poll at least 150,000 votes in a general election, and that you have at least one MP. We registered over 200,000 votes nationwide. We achieved that goal. We overachieved, but we failed on the crucial count of having an MP. But we're down but not out. We're waiting for another by-election chance to crop up, and hopefully then we can restart with a real class-based Labour Party.
One of the problems has been, the main problem in many ways, is the economy is collapsing. It's very difficult for anybody to get a steady job, a well-paid job, a decent career is almost out of the question for a lot of people. This is causing all sorts of, I mean, you know, people having to go to food banks. The basic standard of living is dropping. The tax take is dropping, and the money coming to local authorities to even do things like keep public toilets open. I mean, it's becoming very third world Britain these days. That is a difficult one. I wonder, do you think it's possible to fix? I know the Workers' Party wants to see industry reconstituted, the government actually helping start new businesses, medium and small enterprises. But I mean, it doesn't just this seems a million miles away, Peter, from any kind of possibility today.
Yes, well, we don't like to indulge in the Workers' Party in fantasy politics. We are not going to be the government tomorrow or even in 5 years' time. Let's not beat around the bush. But what we can do is campaign for certain things or campaign against certain things. And we're focusing much of our campaign against the stupidities of our economic suicide, our destruction of our oil and gas industries, our plunging headlong into a mad pursuit of net zero, which is not going to work anyway. Even if it did work, it would make no difference to the climate. And in the meanwhile, is sacrificing tens of thousands of existing workers' jobs.
So hang on. Surely, I mean, net zero would make quite a big difference to the climate. That most of the world's scientists agree on that.
Indeed, but Labour are making it a central part of their economic policy, are they not? That is their sort of number one economic policy, mad pursuit of net zero. They lie through their teeth brazenly claiming that it will make energy prices lower when the opposite is the Cape, and they claim it will create new green jobs, but it will decimate existing brown jobs. So this is a major prong of our campaigning and why we demand the nationalization of energy utility companies, because that the companies, the commercial companies operating today, are quite happy to go along with the government lies, because it's not them who pay the price. They, in fact, reap benefits. They're ready to invest in pointless renewables. They're ready to go along with new types of petrol. Breaks my heart every time I fill up, being forced to buy this horrible new E10 petrol, which is petrol mixed with wood shavings, ethanol, and it does less miles per gallon. So I end up spending more and buying more petrol. The petrol companies love it. They love net zero. They have a vested interest in perpetuating the lies. And so we would nationalize them without compensation. They deserve it.
What about the Middle East at the moment? I know you're a former ambassador there. The attack on Tehran, the murder and assassination by the Israelis of the chief Hamas negotiator, the BBC called it audacious. Most of the rest of the world called it a war crime and an act of war against Tehran, against Iran, by the Israelis. And we're now being told, quite a lot of British citizens and other foreign citizens are being told, get out of the Middle East, quick.
Yes, I too noticed the BBC's use of that neutral word, audacious. I think a better word would have been reckless. A better word would have been criminal. A better word would have been stupid. But no, the BBC call it audacious, almost praiseworthy, in fact, in BBC speak. And our government could not bring themselves to utter a word of criticism of that assassination, that murder, or indeed any Israeli actions. In recent days, they have been hovering on the brink of expressing some mild criticism of Israel, particularly after the slaughter of innocents a few days ago in a school in Gaza, when probably over 100 people, most of them children, were killed. But they play with words in the Foreign Office way with which I'm very familiar. So the Foreign Office wouldn't actually condemn Israel. They condemned the loss of life. They condemned the tragic loss of life without saying who was the perpetrator. I used to be paid good money to come up with weasel words like that. I recognize it immediately. They're trying to throw sand in people's eyes, putting it about quietly that they are in practice limiting arms sales to Israel. But officially, there's no change. And this is the key operative question at the moment for the British government. Will you, or are you, stopping arms sales to Israel, which are directly involved in the bombing by F-35 planes, which includes about 15% British component? Will they institute immediately no more shilly-shallying, an arms embargo? And the current answer is no. And they're getting away with it. So they're sending, as a substitute for real action, they're sending the ridiculous the man masquerading as Foreign Secretary, David Lammy, sending him hotfoot to meet Netanyahu in the next couple of days. It's grotesque, this posturing, this pretending to take action, when real action an arms embargo is taken off the table, in the same way that the Americans tut-tut about the latest Israeli excesses, and then in the next breath they announce $20 billion worth of arms sales to Israel over the coming years. If they think they're fooling anyone with this, I don't know what universe they're in.
I mean, you mean surely it's Lammy's job as foreign secretary now. He's also an attendee from the Bilderberg conference. We were there over in Lisbon in last year in 2023 to see him turn up at the financial oligarchs of the West's little secret club. And they wouldn't let him in. He didn't have the right security, so he hid behind a bush, and he was trying to phone them to let him in. And eventually someone came out. He eventually got in. But it was all very embarrassing for him. But he's part of his job, Peter, isn't it? He's got to go over there, and maybe he'll actually be gently leaning on Netanyahu, saying, come on, it's time for a ceasefire.
I rather doubt it, Tony. He's going there so that journalists will say that he's trying to lean on Netanyahu, but I think Netanyahu will barely condescend to speak to David Lammy. I don't think David Lammy comes from the kind of background that Netanyahu is very comfortable with. But Lammy may get lucky. He may get lucky because, contrary to the alarmism of everybody else who's talking about the Middle East at the moment, the so-called experts, all the talking heads tell us that Iran is going to wreak a terrible vengeance on Israel, and that's going to set off a conflagration. I predict that this will not happen. I'm sticking my neck out here, and maybe even as early as tomorrow or the next day, you can have a good laugh about my prediction. But that's the way it goes when you are a realist. You see, the alarmists always, or they're never called to account. All those people who said, for example, the last time an Iranian general was killed by the Americans, I think 3 years ago. All the experts, the alarmists said, oh, it's going to be Armageddon. It didn't happen. It didn't happen. And I don't think it will happen again this time. Why? Because the Iranians are not stupid. They know when they are being goaded. That's what's going on at the moment. That is the game that Israel and America are playing. The Israelis have tried to goad the Iranians. From what I know of the Iranians, they will not let themselves be controlled and manipulated into taking unwise action that will backfire. And the same goes for Hezbollah. And in the politics of warfare, there's no room for the word revenge. Revenge satisfies an emotion. It doesn't satisfy a practical policy need. And revenge will make no difference to the things that really matter. The outcome in Gaza, Iran's continued progress as a radical country, the success of the Houthis in striking the Israeli economy. None of those things would be advanced by Iran inviting America to attack it. So I don't think Iran or Hezbollah will fall into that trap. So Lammy may get lucky. You know, he'll go and then the Iranians don't attack, and he can take credit for it.
Well, there's quite a lot of airlines and national governments that would disagree with you The airlines particularly have been cancelling all their flights to Israel, Jordan and Lebanon. They see this as a very serious possibility that the nations have been warning, saying, look, something could really kick off here.
Well, indeed, they don't have much choice, the airlines, because they have to follow the lead set by governments. And the British government issued official advice to its citizens in Lebanon to evacuate the country. You see, nobody will be called to account when nothing happens. All that disruption, all that distress caused by this alarmism, when it's all over and nothing terrible has happened, will they be called to account? Of course they will not be called to account. Alarmists are never called to...
Well, they'll say we were just erring on the side of caution, weren't they?
Yes, and I dare say if I was the boss of an airline, I'd do the same. The downside of taking precautions is not so high that it outweighs the potential cost. But if we're talking about serious political analysis, then I believe that the Iranians would be foolish to attack on this timing. I'm not saying retaliation will not come, but on this timing, I think it would be more in character and wiser for the Iranians and Hezbollah to bide their time, as they have done on occasions past.
Meanwhile, in Jerusalem, we've had Israel's Ben Gavir, far-right kingmaker, he's called by some. He's one of the members of Netanyahu's Greater Israel Cabinet. He has gone to the Al-Aqsa Mosque to lead Jewish prayers, which the many of the Muslims see as a provocation. What do you make of this site? Because it's been cited by some as a potential flashpoint for a religious war.
Yeah. Yes, this man is a real piece of work, isn't he? He never misses an opportunity to make things work. Never misses an opportunity to stir up more hatred and tension. And that's his game at the moment, when you might think that matters could hardly be more inflamed than they are already. He chooses that moment to make the super inflammatory gesture of taking a bunch of his fellow thugs to pray at Al-Aqsa.
Well, hang on, but aren't you guilty of scaremongering here? Because these guys are not armed with tear gas or guns or automatic weapons. They're there to pray. Surely this is fine. It should be fine.
But there are long-standing... Well, point one, the Israelis have no right to be in there. They are squatters on that territory. They have no right whatsoever to enter Al-Aqsa or any part of Eastern Jerusalem. Under international law, as recently confirmed by the International Court of Justice, the occupied territories, of which Eastern Jerusalem is part, is illegally occupied. So that's point one. Israeli ministers have no right whatsoever to pray at Al-Aqsa and to take their thuggish followers. And secondly, it's been established practice for many, many years that Jews would not try to pray in large numbers or to do it discreetly. And this has been tolerated as a sort of favor to the Israeli occupiers. But Ben-Gvir has chosen to throw that out of the window on this timing, specifically to make a settlement in Gaza even less likely than it is.
Look, the Zionists say that this site is actually their site. And obviously, there is this big of tug of war going on, Peter. And what about my point about this being a potential flashpoint for a religious war? Well, maybe I shouldn't call it a religious war, a pseudo-religious war with the Zionists taking on the whole of Islam, really.
Well, I think that's a bit fanciful. What's going on is that the religious ethno-nationalists of Israel, led by this minister, are trying to block any kind of settlement in Gaza that would involve the withdrawal of Israeli forces. They're not looking for a war with the whole of Islam. For one thing, that would be stupid. That is just not going to happen. If the Gaza crisis has taught us one thing, surely it is that Islam is pretty much decided not to do anything meaningful about Gaza, whatever the suffering of the Palestinians. We hear, do we not, pretty dreadful sounds of women in Gaza just being bombed or lost their children, wailing. Where are the Arabs? Where is Islam? We know that nothing is going to come from that quarter, and that Israelis know this and have nothing to fear on that score. This is all about the war between the resistance led by Hamas and Islamic Jihad and Israel. At the end of the day, nothing else matters. This entire conflict will be decided by the military equation of the Palestinian resistance, the immovable object against the irresistible force of the IDF.
And what do you make of the attack on the school? Over 100 people killed whilst at prayers on Saturday.
Well, the world has become more or less inured to Israeli violence. This one was particularly shocking, of course, involving, as it did, a school and so many children. But this has become the new normal, which the Israelis and their Western backers have habituated us. We're beyond shockability anymore. All that this dreadful attack elicited was a little bit of a rap on the knuckles from the Western powers, calls on Israel to be more restrained and to be respectful of international law. It's pathetic. Absolutely, shockingly pathetic, and it shows only the hypocrisy of those who pose as peacemongers while all the time in practice encouraging Israel to get on with the job of destroying the Palestinian resistance.
Well, yeah, but the Israelis have said that there were Hamas fighters hiding in the school.
Well, they would say that, wouldn't they? I visited Gaza many times when I was working for the UN, for the agency which is responsible for half the schools in Gaza, UNRWA. And I can state with fair certainty that it's unthinkable for the resistance to be operating out of UNRWA schools. I can't give the same or express the same certainty with regard to the state operated schools in Gaza. But I think it highly unlikely that Hamas would be so foolish as to put themselves in the line of fire, because surely the Israelis have taught us that they're absolutely disrespectful of hospitals and schools. The idea that anyone could think that they could put a command headquarters in a school It's just ridiculous. They're asking us to believe something which is just stupid. But we are just stupid. Our government and many of the apologists for Israel in our media buy this at face value.
Well, this year has seen the 75th anniversary, I think it is, or roughly that anyway, of the signing of the Geneva Conventions and international humanitarian law being started 45 years ago in Geneva. And this was a settlement which was put together by many of the people who had lived through World War II, and particularly through having to deal with the SS, the Nazis, and the extreme elements within the, you know, the German Nazi Party system. And yet it doesn't seem as if these are being implemented at all. I mean, the two basic bits of international humanitarian law, number one, are that you treat your enemy combatants when they surrender in a humane manner. Well, we've seen, well, I'm sure you can add to this list, but we've seen physical abuse of prisoners, even rape of prisoners, torture of prisoners. And the other aspect is making sure that civilians are protected. So, for example, if it looks as if there is a sort of mingling of combatants and civilians, that there's some sort of immediate ceasefire, that the two are separated before fighting can continue. Now, it seems as if really these things are no longer worth the paper they're written on, if you start to look at Gaza, Peter.
Well, this is not new, Tony. There's never been a time when Israel respected the Geneva Conventions. And let's remind ourselves that although this is the worst episode with Gaza, there have been previous rounds, at least three that I can remember, when the Israelis killed thousands and thousands of Palestinian civilians.
We're now up to 40,000 civilians killed here now.
A different order of magnitude now, absolutely. But Israel has always been, to use the American term, a scofflaw. They scoff at international law. For them, it's a joke. They cock a snook at international law and the Geneva Conventions. And in a way, they're right to do so, because they're never called to account. There is never the slightest suggestion that the Western powers will in any way punish Israel. Now, belatedly, the machinery of international government has clanked into action, and there is a remote prospect of Netanyahu one day being hauled up before a court in The Hague if he's unwise enough to step into a country that would implement a judgment by the ICC. So to that extent, these recent decisions or moves by the international instances, the criminal court and the Court of Justice, are quite significant. This is the first time since Israel's inception when Israel has, to some extent, at least in legal terms, started to be called into account for these breaches of international law, in particular the murder of thousands of civilians.
Yeah, I mean, even a child can see that this is wrong. Anybody with a conscience can see that what's happening is disgusting, appalling, and evil. I think it's important to use that term. And yet the British people, through the British government, are still supporting this, Peter. There were even rumours that there may be a review of arms licences to sell British weapons, British-made weapons and Israeli-made weapons here in Britain, at Elbit Systems, to Israel. But no actual change. So what's in it for us?
We were told that Starmer had spoken for half an hour to the new Iranian president. How interesting it would be to have a transcript of that, but I somehow think we're not going to get it. After it, Farmers People put out a statement which was so shockingly one-sided. He said he called on the Iranians to exercise restraint. Well, what about restraint from the Israelis? No breath of Britain being ready to apply the brakes to Israel. No, they're only calling on Iran, which has been provoked and attacked in its capital by Israel, and it's Iran which has to show the restraint. I mean, how one-sided can you get?
Can you say something about any connections you think there might be between the far-right unrest and the situation with Israel?
Well, it's common knowledge that Tommy Robinson is a big supporter of Israel, has made visits to Israel, has been celebrated, welcomed by the Israelis, and to all intents and purposes acts as someone who's working in the Israeli interest. And it would hardly be surprising that Israel would welcome someone like Tommy Robinson, who encourages his followers to be aggressive towards Muslims, and whose followers have been so instrumental in whipping up the violence, that much of it anti-Muslim in character, that we witnessed on our streets. This is probably the catalyst for the whole thing. There was a lot of dry tinder lying around, built up over many years. But what's been happening is that the far right, I hesitate to use that term, but it's shorthand, you know what I mean. The far right focused on Islam. It's no accident. They didn't go after Rwanda, did they? They didn't go after black Africa or Christians, as they might have done after the dreadful Southport killings. No, it was directed against Muslims, and a concerted effort went on to whip up anti-Muslim hysteria.
We've had the charging of, I believe, six people here in Bristol who allegedly used a prison van to ram their way through the perimeter fence and then smash their way into an Elbit factory, which is one of the headquarters of Elbit, and then with sledgehammers proceeded to allegedly smash up drones and things being manufactured for the Israelis. What do you make of this?
Well, this is wrong. It's wrong to use violence for political ends like that. However commendable it is to try to apply pressure, it is wrong to use violence in that way. And it's not good for the cause. It's not good for the Palestinians. It may give a certain emotional satisfaction to some supporters of Palestinians, but it will not actually help the cause. And I'm afraid I have to say much the same of our marches, including the marches in which I participated myself. Looking back, they made us feel better about ourselves. We felt that we'd done our bit, but they haven't made a blind bit of difference either to British policy or to the situation in the region. We have to be honest about that. And neither will actions such as those that you described.
Also this week, it'd be interesting to see if you've got any comment on the arrest of the climate protesters. This time, they weren't even allowed to do a protest. They were just getting ready with their tent to set up a climate camp near the big forest burning power station called Drax up in Yorkshire, and they were arrested before they even got a chance to set the camp up.
Well, I'm unsighted on that one, Tony, and not instinctively sympathetic towards climate alarmists. I don't know the circumstances here, but normally when you set up camp on someone's land, you need permission. From the sound of it, I rather doubt they had permission.
Let's just finish on Ukraine, because there's been an enormous... apparently using British tanks. In fact, they were showing some of the British Challenger tanks being used by the Ukrainians inside Russia.
I don't know how welcome this will be to the Labour government. I suspect it's the Ukrainians and their allies who've pushed out this bit of news, which may or may not be true. I mean, just seeing a few pictures of a couple of tanks, they could be anywhere in the world. I'm not going to jump to the conclusion that they're using British tanks inside Russia, although they may well be, perfectly possible. But I will not let myself be manipulated by whoever brought this piece of news or fake news into the public awareness. But what can't be denied is that the British government has been playing with fire and tossing lighted matches onto petrol, with the result that the Russians, for their part, have put it about that Varroian Furnace might be their first line of attack if any of these lighted matches actually set fire to the fuel.
So what's in Varroian Furnace that the Russians might be annoyed about?
Well, Varroian Furnace, of course, is one of the headquarters of the British arms industry. I think BAE. And certainly Rolls-Royce are there, shipyards are there, nuclear submarines used to be built there. As far as I know, they may be repaired there. If I were a Russian, it would certainly make strategic sense to paint a bullseye over Varroian Furnace.
How likely is that, or is this just a sort of saber-rattling?
Well, I wouldn't like to put it to the test, frankly. I mean, and here's an instance of me being an alarmist, but no one will pay any attention to me over this type of alarmism when there might actually be a risk of this country, not some remote country in the Middle East, but this country being harmed in the most serious imaginable way. So I would say that even if there was only a 0.0001% chance of it happening, we should attach more significance and worry to that than other contingencies like Iran attacking Israel, which might be a 50-50 chance. If Britain was involved in a nuclear exchange, the consequences, well, don't need me to spell them out. We should be alarmed about this. We should be alarmed, but we're not. It's not in the government's interest, not in the mainstream media interest to sound the alarms about this. But I'm doing what I can, reminding you this evening.
It might be in American interests. It might be in interests of foreign powers. And anyway, one of Russia's chief advisors said a couple of months ago, he said, well, we won't be nuking Britain. There's no need because it's destroying itself from within anyway. Anyway, Peter Ford, former ambassador to Syria and elsewhere, thanks very much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure, Tony. Thank you.